From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a frank discussion with Michael Korda about prostate cancer. He was diagnosed 2 years ago and had radical surgery. His new memoir addresses the after effects of surgery, which many men have trouble discussing, incontinence and impotence. Korda is the editor-in-chief at Simon & Schuster. Also today, a comic who's built much of his act around the tension between Arabs and Jews. We meet stand-up comic John Cowie. He's Lebanese-American. And film critic Lisa Schwartzbaum reviews Cold Comfort Farm. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. India's president has asked the leader of the United Front Party to form a new government. H.D. Dev Gowda, the new prime minister, says his leftist party has been asked to create the new government. India's first Hindu nationalist government collapsed this morning when Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee resigned. He'd been in power for 12 days. The new government is a coalition of socialist and lower caste parties. A Japanese religious sect leader, on trial for ordering the gassing of the Tokyo subway, has appeared in court for a second time. Authorities are determining whether his sect should be banned. The BBC's Juliet Hendel reports from Tokyo.
Shoko Asahara is trying to save his cult from being banned. To do so, he has to prove that it poses no threat to society. The Public Security Agency wants to ban the cult under Japan's anti-subversion law. That would mean that members would no longer be allowed to practice their beliefs, hold meetings, or publish articles or books about the Om faith. Today, the cult leader told investigators that he would step down as leader of the cult if that would prevent it from being disbanded. He said he wanted the cult to continue even after his death. His lawyers presented as evidence a letter Shoko Asahara wrote to his followers from prison. In the letter, he said he was trying to starve himself to death. He asked why someone who wanted to die would want to harm society. The cult leader told the hearing he had already tried to commit suicide twice while in prison.
Juliet Hendel reporting. Astronauts aboard the space shuttle Endeavour are winding up experiments and getting ready to come home. The crew completed its last task yesterday with a record-breaking fourth satellite rendezvous. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
Scientists on Earth are anxiously awaiting a look at the shiny gold Spartan satellite in the shuttle's payload bay. Spartan served as the base for possibly the most photogenic cargo on the shuttle, the inflatable antenna that grew to the size of a giant silver pie pan. While Endeavour's astronauts were taking pictures from a distance, Spartan was taking notes up close. The satellite doesn't transmit that data, so scientists will have to wait until after the landing. Endeavour will also leave a calling card of sorts in orbit. It launched a satellite designed to fly straight without jet thrusters. NASA says it's doing so well on its own that it will likely remain in orbit until January of next year. Four space shuttle missions will have flown by then. For National Public Radio, I'm Pat Duggins reporting.
A private business research group says consumer confidence dipped slightly this month. The conference board says its index fell slightly from April. Lower expectations dragged the index lower. A spokesman says much of the decline came from grain-producing states. The Midwest is suffering through its worst drought in decades. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 40 points at 5,722. Trading is active. This is NPR. Albanian riot police broke up an anti-government rally in the capital, Tirana, today. Four opposition leaders were apparently arrested. International monitors say Albania's weekend elections were rigged. The ruling Democratic Party of Albania claimed a landslide victory in the disputed polling over the main opposition, the socialists, formerly the communists. Norwegian and British monitors who checked reports of voting irregularities officially say the voting did not meet international standards for free and fair elections. A survey by Milwaukee-based Manpower Incorporated says a lot of job opportunities will be available this summer. Andrea Rowe of member station WUWM reports from Milwaukee.
Manpower Incorporated is the nation's largest temporary employment agency. The company surveyed more than 16,000 businesses in the U.S. on hiring plans for June, July, and August. While 27% report plans to do some hiring over the next 3 months, 7% plan to cut their staffing, and 63% are expecting no change. Manpower spokesperson Sharon Cantor.
Now, this is slightly better in terms of hiring plans than what we saw in the last quarter and what the employers reported to us. But it is still a little early to tell if the growth in the job market can be sustained.
Manpower survey suggests companies in the Midwest have the most ambitious hiring plans, with the strongest hiring taking place in the construction industry. For National Public Radio, I'm Andrea Rowe in Milwaukee.
President Clinton will call on the Veterans Affairs Department to extend certain medical benefits to Vietnam veterans who were exposed to Agent Orange. Those with prostate cancer and a nerve disease will benefit. Mr. Clinton is also urging more research into suggestions Agent Orange is linked to spina bifida among children of exposed veterans. Scientists suggest the link between the herbicide and the crippling birth defect may be possible. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Advanta, a financial services provider to consumers and small businesses and sponsor of the upcoming Cezanne documentary on public television. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Prostate cancer hits about 200,000 American men each year. About a quarter of them die. Those who survive typically face a couple of problems that are socially embarrassing and difficult to talk about: incontinence and impotence. Michael Corder has written a new memoir focusing on such difficult-to-discuss problems. This interview will include a frank discussion about the problems of incontinence and impotence, which are typical parts of prostate cancer recovery. Corder was diagnosed a couple of years ago and had a radical prostatectomy. It's no surprise he'd want to chronicle his experiences in a memoir. He's the editor-in-chief at the publishing house Simon & Schuster and author of several best-selling books. His new memoir is called Man to Man. Corda says that prostate cancer is the male equivalent of breast cancer, but men and women handle the intimate aspects of their illnesses very differently.
Men, I think, are much less used to talking about intimate health matters and sexual matters than women are. I mean, my impression is that whereas women do talk to each other about this kind of thing and talk to each other quite openly and without embarrassment, men do not. I certainly have never in my life experienced that kind of openness and frankness from men or between men. That's a great difficulty with this disease, because everybody knows very well that among the possible consequences of any kind of prostate cancer treatment are incontinence and impotence, which are both of them very frightening to men.
Yeah, as you point out, these fears go to the core of masculinity.
Yes. Well, of course, yeah, that sounds, of course, as if I were making them trivial, which is not really the case. The difficulty with incontinence for most men is that it implies a total loss of control.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty of impotence with men is, of course, obvious. That's one of the great dangers here, is that men are so frightened of either one of these two things or both of them that they will avoid both cancer treatment when it might save their lives, or will avoid the regular checkup and the regular taking of PSA when it's the best way of charting whether you have this disease or not. So the great danger is that men die of this disease out of the ignorance and fear, not from the disease itself.
There's a part in your book where you're looking ahead to your future and you're thinking, no sex, no coffee, no wine, and a closet full of incontinence products. I thought that was the sentence that kind of sums up the type of depression that one might feel facing prostate cancer. And you really write about the inconvenience and the embarrassment of the incontinence that follows immediately after the prostate surgery. And for some men, it lasts a much longer time, and for others, it doesn't.
Oh, indeed, it does. And I must say that I was never depressed as such during the entire experience. But it is nevertheless exceedingly unpleasant before surgery to look forward to what you know the recovery process is likely to be. Now, to be absolutely fair, because we should not frighten men off having treatment for prostate cancer, quite a lot of men recover continence rapidly after surgery. With others it takes weeks, with still others months. It took about a year for me to recover a useful degree of continence. I'm now about 18 months after surgery, and I would say I've recovered about 75 to 85% continence, with some possibility that I will regain a little more over the next 6 months or so. That's not really so terrible. I mean, it's a long time, and the beginning of it is very unpleasant because we're all toilet trained, and the last thing we want to do is to go back to a situation in which we're essentially dealing on an hourly basis and in a very unpleasant and intimate manner with our own waste bodily fluids. But you just have to accept the fact that for a while that's what's going to happen, and you've got to make up your mind not to be squeamish about it.
Well, you know, I think in our culture, incontinence is equated with loss of dignity. And that's something that you probably really have to rethink if you're going to be incontinent. You can't think of it as, well, I'm losing my dignity.
No, I think you have to be very careful not to do that. I think you have to be very careful to put it into context. First of all, there are a lot of people out there who are incontinent, and not all of them are prostate cancer patients. One of the things that you discover is that this is a large fellowship and contains many, many millions of Americans who have continence problems. Beyond that, though, I think there's another kind of male-female point that can be made about this. I think that men are squeamish precisely because, by and large, through their lives, they're not afflicted by this kind of problem. Women who start menstruating at a fairly early age and who have continence problems that almost invariably follow childbirth are, however uncomfortable, are quite at ease with the notion of pads, special products, all the protection devices which we're familiar with. I mean, women are used to carrying maxi pads or Tampaxes in their purse. They live with that, and it's not a big deal for them. It's very difficult for men to do that because men don't live that way. It's alien to any man's idea of the way he should be living, to his self-image. And one of the things that you have to get over precisely is that kind of squeamish discomfort with it. If you can get past that, and you more or less have to get past that, then the process is quite livable with. It may be extended, or it may be quite short, but it can be made bearable.
At the patient support groups that you've been to, did you find it was easy for the men to talk with each other candidly about their bodies? Because as you point out, a lot of men aren't used to talking that way.
So for most of them, certainly not at the beginning. Newcomers are always a little reticent and shy. But men who have been to a couple of prostate cancer support group meetings and become regular attendants at those meetings almost always become absolutely frank. There's nothing to hide because you're among people who have had the same experience.
And you found that useful for yourself, to be able to talk to other men?
Yes, I think that's enormously useful. It's sometimes difficult to talk to women about this subject, partly because, as I say, women experience various forms of incontinence throughout their lifetimes and are therefore much more at ease with the subject than men are, and likely to be somewhat impatient and say, well, you know, why can't you just get on with it? Men, I think, understand much more clearly what it is about incontinence that's so horrifying to other men. And they can be very, very frank on the subject, and most of them are.
Tell me what you think it is that men understand about what's so horrifying about it that women might not.
The loss of power over something that has always been assumed to be totally within your power, i.e. the ability to urinate, ever since you were toilet trained, seems like a terrible affront to any man's image of his own masculinity. For a man, it's very difficult to psych himself into believing that when he's walking around with incontinence pants on, people don't know about it.
Right.
No woman would probably feel that because on a monthly basis, there's something she's going to have to do that's akin to it, if you see what I mean.
When your doctors were preparing you for the after effects of surgery, they would talk about erectile dysfunction. As a writer and editor, how did you feel about that kind of medicalized terminology?
Well, I'm a writer and an editor, and I believe in precise language, but actually erectile dysfunction is exactly what we should be calling it. And shying away from the use of the word impotence. Impotence frightens men for very obvious reasons. And erectile dysfunction is something quite different. Almost every man who has a radical prostatectomy will have a period in which he will not be able to have an erection. That period may be a matter of days, which would be very rare, a matter of weeks, which would be nice, a matter of months, which is usually the case, and very often a matter of a year, 2 years. And, of course, for some percentage of men who have radical prostatectomies, they will lose their ability to have an erection altogether. Now, the reason why it should not be called impotency is because that word implies to men that they will not be able to have a sex life, that they will not be able to have a sexual relationship with a woman. That's simply not the case. Those who are going to recover erectile function will recover it to a greater or lesser degree, but those who do not can have and experience a very rich erotic life with a woman without having an erection. So I try to urge men to think of their erotic lives in terms of feeling, touching, in terms of new erotic experiences that are more a question of contact than a question of penetration, because it's, that will get them over the period when they can't have an erection. Well, they can still have an intense sex life.
A lot of what you're saying is actually very similar to things that women have been saying for a long time anyway.
So that's
interesting. So did you find that you were kind of rethinking sexuality while you were recovering?
Well, there's a period in recuperation as opposed to recovery where, I must say, sex was not on my mind.
I can imagine.
First of all, there's right. the pain and the difficulty
exactly.
and the discomfort.
Exactly.
And then
exactly.
incontinence is a major issue. It is very difficult to imagine having any kind of erotic feeling while you're still incontinent. But as that gets better, yes, then you begin to brood about sexuality.
Your cancer is gone, as far as the doctors can tell, right?
As far as
got it all.
As far as anybody can tell, yes. But you can't ever be sure.
Right.
You live from one PSA test to another.
Michael Korda is my guest. He's the author of the new memoir, Man to Man, Surviving Prostate Cancer. He's also editor-in-chief at Simon & Schuster and author of several earlier bestsellers. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Korda, and he's the author of the new memoir, Man to Man, Surviving Prostate Cancer. When you first went for your surgery, did you take work with you to the hospital? I mean, you have a real high-level job. You added a lot of people. You have an important position at Simon & Schuster. I mean, a lot of your life revolves around work.
Yes, I'm also a full-scale workaholic, as my wife Margaret constantly points out to me. So my first concern going anywhere is to pile enough work into a suitcase so I can keep myself busy. And I did that effectively, you're quite right, in preparing myself for going to hospital for surgery. I found, as any sensible person would have guessed beforehand, that that was a total waste of time. First of all, the surgery is so difficult, so uncomfortable, and so unpleasant an experience that the notion of being able to work at anything with a clear head is very unlikely. And besides that, your entire psyche, your entire energy, your entire set of mental faculties is taken up in trying to come to grips with what's mm-hmm. happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, major surgery is like standing in front of a bus and being hit by it. There's no room in your mind for work. Recovery actually takes a lot of work and thought, and the more work and thought and effort you put into it, the more likely you are to recover. So I did not find that I was able, after the surgery when I got home to start work anything like as quickly as I'd anticipated I would be able to do. On the contrary, what I found was that I needed far more time simply to deal with myself. It's as if there's a period where you have to go back into a cocoon and concentrate on self in order to recover.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're 18 months after the surgery.
I'm 18 months now.
Is the balance of work to the rest of life different now than it was before you got cancer? And do you want it to be? I mean, is your goal to get back to exactly where you were before, or would you like to change things anyways?
No, I think I wanted to change things anyway, and I think that I probably have not to anything like the degree that I intended to, because the moment you do get back to work, it sort of rushes out and embraces you and you plunge back into it. I think that's probably a mistake on my part, and I know my wife Margaret feels that very strongly. I think that you have to emerge from the experience of cancer having learned something. And in my case, I don't think I learned as much as I wanted to. I am conscious of it now, though, and I think that to an increasing degree, I'm aware that I just can't work the way I used to. First of all, I don't have the energy for it, but secondly, I don't really have the desire to. And you can't go through an experience like cancer without realizing how fragile and potentially short life is, and without some determination to make more use of it. I think somebody said, and it may have been Vincent Foster, who's oddly enough credited with having said it, nobody on their deathbed ever wished they'd spent more time at the office.
I've always wondered about that statement, because it's, sure, if all you're doing is punching the clock and going into the office, but if you wanted to write that great novel before you died, or write a great song, or paint a painting, or just, you know, achieve something that something meaningful to you at work, then you might have had regrets.
Yes, I think so. But the truth of the matter is that most people who are workaholics are like any other addicts. They know in their heart of heart their addiction is really base and awful, but they can't break it. I think work addicts are not, generally speaking, work addicts because they're writing great symphonies or anything. They are addicted to work because, like any other form of addiction, it's simply taken over their lives and they can't resist it. You're right, I think, in theory, but in practice, most workaholics know that what they're doing is simply spending many, many, many more hours at their desks doing things than they really need to or that need to be done. And I'm certainly in that category.
We only have a couple of minutes remaining, and I want to just, in the remaining time, shift the conversation a little bit to the publishing industry, which you've been an important part of since the 1970s. What's the major change you've seen in the publishing industry since you got started?
Well, the major change is that the publishers have been bought by large corporations and gotten larger themselves. That sounds as if it's a bad idea, and people will normally suggest that it has got to be a bad idea. I'm not so sure that I agree with that. I think that perhaps the major change in book publishing is that the people who work in it now make pretty much a decent living wage, which they never did before when book publishing houses were owned by, you know, one or two people. But then getting a raise was taking it directly out of Max Schuster's or Bennett Cerf's pocket, as it were. Today, people in book publishing work at about the same financial level that they might in any other comparable business. So I think people are much better off in terms of their lives and their benefits in the new world of publishing than they were in the old world of publishing, which people look back on with a kind of false nostalgia. I also don't think it's had any great effect on what is published. I mean, people will always argue that book publishing was better 20 years ago or 30 years ago or 50 years ago. But frankly, if you go back and look at the New York Times bestseller list, and there is a book where the records are kept, I think, for over 100 years of bestseller lists, pretty much the same kind of books appear on the bestseller list that you would expect to appear on the bestseller list at any given moment.
Do you think there's any major changes in who is reading?
My impression is more people are reading, that there are a lot more readers, and my impression is that there are substantially more serious readers and readers of serious fiction than there ever were before. Not in enormous numbers, but enough to be significant.
That's almost counterintuitive because it seems people are too busy to read now. That's what you always hear.
Yeah, I don't believe that's true at all. And it can't be true. I mean, if people are too busy to read, how are we selling so many books?
Mm-hmm.
Huge quantities of books are being sold. When you look at major best-selling novels like The Horse Whisperer or The Bridges of Madison County sold probably 4 or 5 million copies in hardcover. If you assume that every hardcover book is read by 3 or 4 people, that's maybe 9 to 10 million readers before the book is even in paperback. So, you know, admittedly, you might say, well, but it's not Anna Karenina. But that's never been a concern in him. I mean, you know, the we're not talking about the quality of the book so much as the number of readers. And that, I honestly believe, is growing by leaps and bounds.
Of the books that you've edited, which would you say you're proudest of?
Of the books I've edited?
Mm-hmm.
In fiction, probably Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove, which came about after 20 years of publishing Larry McMurtry. In nonfiction, it would be a toss-up, I think, between David McCullough's biography of Truman and Richard Rhodes' History of the Making of the Atomic Bomb.
Now, you mentioned Larry McMurtry. You thank him in your acknowledgments for being so helpful to you in spite of his own problems. And then you quote him a little later about his own quadruple bypass surgery.
That says everything there is to be said about major surgery, including
prostate cancer. Yeah, I thought it was a wonderful passage.
It's a wonderful quote, and I absolutely agree with him. I'll simply say that he says your personality fragments in major surgery, and when you've recovered from it, you can put some of the pieces back together, but you're never the same person that you were before. And you can remember that person. You may like that person better or less than the person you are now, but you are no longer that person.
And that's how you feel? You're no longer quite the same
person?
I am
no longer the same person at all.
Michael Korda, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Korda's new memoir is called Man to Man. He's editor-in-chief at Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Arab-American comic John Cowie. He gets his laughs from mocking stereotypes of Arabs. And Lisa Schwartzbaum reviews the new film, Cold Comfort Farm. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Arabs and Jews don't typically get together to share a laugh about tensions in the Middle East, but they do when John Cowie is at the mic. He's an Arab-American comic. Both sets of his grandparents came to America from Lebanon. John Cowie performs each weekend at the Improv in New York. Although he's in his mid-40s, he's only performed for a few years. He used to run the family business, which sold tools and equipment to the aerospace industry. Cowie's act is fueled by the latest headlines and by his own experiences.
I went to camp when I was a kid. How many people went to summer camp here, by applause? Summer camp? Yeah. Wow. Not too many. Wow. It was a hassle for me. I ended up rooming with this Jewish kid. What a hassle. We spent the whole summer taking each other's side of the room over. Of course, I was there first. But, Anybody been to Israel? Oh, it's great. No, I was in the Middle East a couple years ago. I'm only kidding. I was in the Middle East a couple years ago. And it's culturally, it's very beautiful, but culturally it's very different. And I realized, for example, singles bars. If you want to pick up a Muslim girl in a singles bar, right, you really have to adjust your technique, right? You see a Muslim girl at the bar, you walk up real slow, you go, hi, baby. So tell me, what do you look like?
John Cowie also talks about how being Arab-American affected his dating life when he was growing up.
It's funny, I do a piece about the father answering the door when I went to pick up a girl and not knowing whether I was black or Puerto Rican. And that actually happened to me. I didn't even write that. I wish I could tell you I did. So it was unusual because I grew up in an Irish neighborhood, and being an Arab American was an unusual thing, especially back in the 60s. It wasn't being Lebanese, so to speak. Some people didn't even know what Lebanese was back then. It was unusual. I felt unusual. I felt I didn't quite fit in. I wasn't black. I wasn't white. It was this middle-of-the-road kind of thing, you know?
And so people were always assuming you were some other ethnic group.
Yeah, Filipino or something, you know? It was unusual. And in my family, we had very strong Arab roots because I lived with my grandfather and grandmother, and they came over here during the turn of the century and so on. So, you know, I really grew up with strong Arab ties.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's such a history in America of Jewish comics and of Jewish audiences for comedy. I get the feeling you really work with that in your performances.
It's funny because some of my best audiences in New York especially are Jewish because they understand my references and understand what I'm saying, although there are certain people that that will always take offense. I like it. I work with that edginess, and I like to bring the Arab point of view forward, you know, and just say, look, this is another way of looking at the Middle East situation or at the absurdity that's going on there.
Are there certain things in your performances that you know are more likely to be controversial or that some people are likely to find offensive?
There's some things I try to push the envelope a little bit. I do one joke now recently where after I tell the audience I'm Lebanese, I look at them and say, well, if you don't know where Lebanon is, all you have to do is just go to Tel Aviv and follow any F-15. Chances are you'll hit Lebanon. So, you know, that's a little edgy for me, and it makes a statement without saying something directly. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
Well, but I like that kind of thing. I love that. I love it. That's why stand-up is so great. That's why comedy's great, because you can make these statements in a way that you can't. It's like poetry. You can't make it any other way.
Now, are there things that you say that you think Arab Americans might find offensive?
Yes. I did a multicultural show once, and there were some Arab-American people in the audience. And when I started my set, I play off the stereotypes, the terrorism, the, you know, hostage crisis and hijacking planes and so on. And they were getting nervous because they thought I was perpetuating this stereotype. So they're looking at me like, what are you doing? You know, this is what we're trying to get away from in this country. This is, we don't want to be looked on as terrorists or as plane hijackers, you know? So it's tough for me because I'm always walking that tightrope between my own people and the Arab background and then, you know, the Jewish side of it and everything else. So it's kind of difficult sometimes.
Give us a sense of how you work with the stereotype of Arabs as terrorists and hijackers.
Sometimes I say, you know, I love New York. I love walking around New York looking like a suspect at the World Trade Center bombing. And then I go into a bit where I say airports are pretty tough for me. I walked to an airport once and they had a full-length mirror. I looked in the mirror and went, ah, oh, it's me, you know. plus, there's always a guy in the ticket line going to Bermuda, whistling, happy. And then he looks, spots me at the end of the ticket line and he looks at the ticket guy and he goes, excuse me, sir, is this guy going to be on the plane? You know what? I got plenty of time. I'll walk, really.
Now, how much is this based on truth? I mean, do people look at you funny at airports?
Yeah, I get that feeling. Maybe it's because it's, you know, it's just the way I am. But, yeah, I get the feeling that people look at me certain ways. Yes, definitely.
No, I think that it's really true that comics of a certain ethnic group can get away with saying things that other people couldn't say. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, if you're a Jewish comic, you could say certain things about being Jewish that no one who's not Jewish would ever be allowed to say.
Right.
Is it the same with you?
Yeah, I guess I can tend to get away with certain things that maybe somebody else couldn't, just because I'm an Arab American.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain things, and I make black references too. Once a black guy in the audience was heckling me, and I said, "Look, don't heckle me. We don't do drive-bys. We do buildings. Okay? It's a different thing. You guys just shoot the guy. We go, it is for Allah, you know, and that is it, you know. So so it's like I love them to take the mix of the, you know, blacks or Irish or you know, the racial mix and the ethnic mix and mix it up and point the stereotypes out. And then through that, you just view the absurdity and go, you know, this is ridiculous, isn't it? You know, the way we view ourselves sometimes.
Now, when there's a period of particularly heightened tension or fighting between Israel and Lebanon, like there has been lately. Uh-huh. Does that affect perceptions of you, or does that affect your performances?
Yes, very much so. At times, to my surprise, I did a shoot once in New York, and it was for television. And that day, I believe a Lebanese gentleman shot some Hasidics in Brooklyn. And it was on the news that day, and I just came out and did my set. I didn't even mention it, and I could feel the tension, you know. I could feel the cool breeze blowing in, you know. It was an awful feeling, but there was nothing I could do. And I think the news affected that, and it does. It does affect it, especially if they're, you know, especially if there's a lot of Hamas bus bombings and things like this. It's tough.
Do you ever try to start out by directly acknowledging that? To kind of break the tension.
Sometimes I'll say, you know, it's bad enough I can't fly. Now I can't take a bus anywhere. You know, I mean, I'm going to be walking across America, I think. So, you know, I try to make it funny, but, you know, sometimes what I think is funny and what the group thinks is funny are maybe two different things. So I like to be edgy, but I don't want to, you know, my object isn't to offend anybody.
Comic John Cowie is my guest. Now, you actually didn't start performing till you were, I think, nearly 40.
Yes. I started this 5 years ago. I ran my family's company for 13 years and worked in the company for 17 years before that.
So when you got out of the business, sold the business, how did you make the transition into performing?
I started doing open mics in Connecticut. As I knew I was negotiating the sale and I knew it was going to be, you know, happening. So I started doing open mics. And then I went to radio school thinking I could do voiceovers and then I just started working on my set and I was so bad. I mean, you know, I had no clue.
Give us a sense of how bad. What were some of your early jokes?
Well, during that time, Salman Rushdie was the big news of the day, and Wade Boggs, the player for the Red Sox, was having an affair. And he was in the news very heavily. So I did this thing called the insecurity blanket. And I walked out on stage with a garbage bag over my head. And I started talking about the insecurity blanket and Salman Rushdie. And this is what he was wearing. And, you know, because Salman Rushdie was running from the Ayatollah at that time. And there was not one laugh. I mean, but thank God I was under this garbage bag because it was just so pitiful, you know. So I said, geez, I don't really know what to do here, you know. And then finally, I took this course with this guy, and he said, one day he said, bring in 2 minutes on talking about yourself. And that's what opened my eyes.
What was in that 2 minutes?
The camp joke was actually in that 2 minutes. Some of my best stuff was in that 2 minutes about talking about being an Arab American. And then I just said, that's it. This is what it's about. This is what it's about, going back and talking about your life. This is what it's about, not about trying to be clever, you know, mm-hmm. With no reality.
Now, getting started, did you feel that it was helpful or that it held you back to have the identity as the, you know, an Arab American comic, you know, who did a lot of very first person type material?
I thought it was a benefit because I had never heard this point of view before. So mm-hmm. for me, Richard Pryor was my hero. In terms of he brought black culture to the stage, to white people, basically, and Dick Gregory and these guys. So I thought, well, you know, this is, I felt kind of good because this is a culture that no one's heard about in this way. You know, they only see the Valentino movies and, you know, the Arab terrorists, as I said, and the hijackers, but they haven't heard from somebody who's an Arab American and who's talking about what it's like.
My guest is comic John Cowie. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with comic John Cowie. Much of his act comes out of his experiences as an Arab American. My impression is that your father was a real mover and shaker. He not only owned his own business, but he was the chair of the Springfield Police Commission?
Yes. Yeah. And he was also a director of St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. He knew Danny Thomas very well.
Really?
Yeah. And he worked for Jack Kennedy's campaign. He knew Ted Kennedy very well. Ted Kennedy stayed at our house. My dad was amazing, and I never knew this, you know, when I was growing up, because he always would do these things, like just go off and do these things and never come back and say anything, you know. Well, so he was amazing.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, at the same time you probably felt like you were part of, you know, a minority ethnic group when you were growing up, minority in America, and at the same time your father is like part of the establishment.
Yeah, he was, as a matter of fact, and a businessman, so you think he'd be a Republican, but he was always strictly a Democrat because of his heritage and because of his, I think, immigrant status. I think he always related to the Democratic Party.
What brought your grandparents from Lebanon to America?
It was, I think, that wave during the early 1900s, where there was a lot of immigrants that came over to the New World. My grandfather came over with like $14 and, you know, the Ellis Island stories. And then he brought his brothers over. And after he brought his brothers over, he needed someone to take care of him, so he married my grandmother. You know, that's what they did, you know? I mean, it was almost like Avalon. You know, the movie Avalon mm-hmm. was very familiar to me. And that was a Jewish experience.
Right.
And see how close it is. And when I watched that movie, I said, my God, it's my family, you know? It's exactly what happened. It came to the New World, and my grandfather was successful from the day he hit this beach. He was successful. He was a peddler, and then he became a dry goods store owner, and then he got into the garment industry. We used to kid my uncle because he was the only Arab in a Jewish business, because we used to sell to pinafores and aprons to Macy's and Gimbel's in New York.
So how much of Arab culture was in your house growing up?
Oh, quite a bit. The whole family spoke Arabic. Anybody that came over usually stopped at our house. You know, it was like a way station to go to Toledo or wherever else. There are a lot of Lebanese families. So it was amazing. And half of my family is Greek Orthodox and half of my family was Maronite Catholic. So we'd had two Easters, you know, because the Easters were always different. And it was very, culturally it was very big. And my grandfather always told me, never lose your heritage. That was like, he always used to, always said that to me, never lose your heritage, never lose your heritage. So it was very big. Arabic music was playing all the time. Arabic, authentic Arabic cooking. I mean, it was just amazing. It was great. I was very fortunate.
Did you feel as strongly as your grandfather wanted you to about not losing your culture? Or did you identify more with American pop culture?
Well, I went through a period of both, I think. When I was a kid, I didn't want anything to do with Arabic culture, but my dad wanted me to go to the American University of Beirut, and I got in, but I didn't want to go because I was here, and I was into, you know, being a hippie and Jimi Hendrix and you know, Woodstock and that kind of thing. But I always enjoyed it. My friends enjoyed the Arabic music because at that time the Beatles were doing the Indian thing and the sitar music, and it was very similar.
Mm-hmm.
So they thought my father was hip because my father used to have these 8-track tapes in his car with this blaring Arabic music. And so, you know, my friends would go, wow, your dad's really amazing, man. He's into this great music, you know. So it was fun.
Have you been to Lebanon or any other parts of the Middle East?
No. No, and I wish I went to the American University of Beirut. That's one regret I do have. I wish I had gone when I was 18. It would have been a great experience. It would have been before the Civil War. The country was beautiful. Beirut was the Geneva of the East at that time. Switzerland of the East. I mean, all the money went through Beirut. It was too bad I never went. And then, of course, in 75, the Civil War happened, and that was out.
Now, do you think that you have a different attitude toward performing and dealing with things because you got started, you know, toward midlife as opposed to as when you were really young, which is when most comics start?
Yeah, I guess so. There's part of me, I guess maybe I'm more centered or whatever because I'm a little older. But the other part of me is frustrated because this industry is a very image-oriented industry as well. So I'm very Semitic looking. I'm an older guy, and you know, television and movies, and they put you into a type, and you know, it's hard to break in. It's hard to break into that kind of situation because they're looking for young guys, or they're looking for the young, you know, American-looking person, and that's been tough. So I'm not only 46 years old, but I'm also very Semitic looking. So you combine both of those, and you know, I don't know if that would play well in Iowa. You know, I'd make a joke about saying, you know, I'm going to have my own, you know, like there's no network guy on the phone with my agent going, Bobby, yeah, we want that guy that looks like a young Saddam Hussein. Get him out here, you know. Yeah, because we got a great show for him. Homeland Improvement. That's everybody's under fire. You know, that's what they're looking for. A guy that looks like a cross between Gregory Hines and Mahatma Gandhi, you know. So it's tough. It's tough to be that, to have that look. You know what I'm saying? It's very difficult.
But since you got started when you were nearly 40, I bet you bypassed a whole type of crude body function type of humor that a lot of young comics get started with.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a lot of stuff that you know, I don't find very funny. Some of the alternative and edgy comedy, you know, today is like, you know, it's at the point where sometimes it's grotesque.
Do a lot of audiences who show up at the open mics and at the comedy clubs tend to be younger audiences who are expecting the body function type of humor?
Open mics are tough. I would say the regular showcase shows here with all the clubs in New York, the audiences tend to be young to middle-aged. Yeah, some of the late night sets are very crude. I mean, it's 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes that's what you have to do to keep these people awake. You know, it's really bad, and you don't learn sometimes from those sets. You know, I mean, you know, yeah, you survive, then you learn how to survive, and you learn how to get away with certain things. But then, what do you really learn from your craft? It's amazing. I don't know if Woody Allen would really make it in stand up today. Or Nichols and May, or some of these people that are very bright and had great, great stand-up careers. But I don't know if people want to listen today. Everything is bang, bang, bang today. You know, a lot of television, a lot of MTV images. You know, hit me with a joke. You know, they don't want to think. And Woody Allen stuff, and Nichols and May, and even Pryor's, and some of that stuff is thoughtful, intelligent humor.
What do you have coming up?
At this time, I've got a sitcom treatment I'm working on, and I've got a one-person show I'm just starting to work on. I've been taking a lot of acting classes, so I'm starting to explore the idea of not having to make people laugh all the time. You know, where in stand-up comedy, you're constantly really have to make people laugh during a set, which is your job. That's the first job, is to entertain.
Mm-hmm.
But in a one-person show, I'm thinking, gee, it would be wonderful to explore the pathos in some other areas of being an Arab American. For example, there's one example where I was at Fenway Park during the hostage crisis, and I was getting a beer, and two guys behind me were drunk, and I could hear one of them say, "Do you smell a sand nigger?" And I just, you know, sat. I mean, I stood there, and I'm going, "Oh my God, I've never heard that before, sand nigger," you know, and they were obviously referring to me, being an Arab American. Now, how do I make that funny? I've tried and I can't. So, but in a one-person show, I could really work with something like that. And that's an experience that I still get chills about when I think about it.
So what are you going to make of it, though, in your one-person show?
I'm not sure, but I'll be able to talk about it and have silence in the audience and have that be okay,
mm-hmm.
you know, as opposed to being in a bar, in a club with people drinking and coming to a comedy show. I mean, they want to see a comedy show. You know, they don't want to hear me talk about that, some experience like that. But a one-person show is more of a theater piece to me. And so, therefore, you have humor in it, but you also have a lot of other things.
Okay.
So it's an interesting, that'd be an interesting thing to explore.
John Cowie, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks, Terry. It's been great. It's been a lot of fun.
John Cowie performs weekends at the Improv in New York.
Anyhow, you know what, though? Someone once said that peace is not the absence of war, but the presence of justice. And I sincerely, sincerely hope, especially with the crazies that are going on over there, if we get rid of the radicals over there, maybe we'll have peace this year. Huh, folks? Don't you? I hope so. I really hope so. Plus, I like to work the Catskills. You know what I mean? And peace is okay, but peace with a career move, you know what I'm saying? So you guys have been great. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you. John Cowie!
Coming up, a review of the new film Cold Comfort Farm. This is Fresh Air. A pub called The Condemned Man, a congregation called Church of the Quivering Brethren. You might think you're in Charles Adams country, but says critic Lisa Schwartzbaum, you're in the singular neighborhood of Cold Comfort Farm, a new movie by John Schlesinger. Here's Lisa's review.
Why, you ask, should you run out to see a small BBC film based on a dark and funny 1932 English novel when you've got a summer amusement park full of big and shiny new American movies to choose from? Why pick something starring a bunch of masterpiece theater types when thousands around you are plunking down bucks to watch expensive doodahs starring Tom Cruise, the biggest and shiniest American of them all? Simple. Sometimes when Hollywood is a little too shiny and gizmo-driven, it's small, tasty sweeties like Cold Comfort Farm that deliver the coolest pleasures. Between now and the 4th of July, when tornadoes, dragons, comic book characters, spies, prisoners, and aliens are vying for our attention, Cold Comfort Farm is a reminder that wit matters. It's been a while since director John Schlesinger has given us a film as smart as he is. How the guy who made Midnight Cowboy and Marathon Man could have mucked around with Sally Field as a vigilante mom in last year's awful Eye for an Eye is beyond me. But with this perfectly tuned adaptation of Stella Gibbons' beloved novel, Schlesinger gets back where he belongs, in a burnished little world filled with people who are intentionally and unintentionally hilarious. Gibbons wrote her novel as a satire on the chest-heaving rural romances of D.H. Lawrence, where men with sweaty, dirt-streaked bodies spoke in muddy rural dialects. In Cold Comfort Farm, which adapts the book spiffily with a zingy script by Malcolm Bradbury, Kate Beckinsale, from Much Ado About Nothing, plays the orphan society girl Flora Post. Flora is impoverished but cheery about it. Fancying a career as a writer, she tells her swanky London mentor, played by the delish Joanna Lumley from TV's Absolutely Fabulous, that she'll go live with the relatives who will provide the most grist for her novelistic mill.
Of course, you can stay here as long as you like, darling, but you'll probably want to take up some kind of work sometime. Earn enough for a flat of your own.
What kind of work?
It's ages since I did any, but there must be something that would suit you. Bookkeeping? Beekeeping?
I can't do that, Mary. Really?
Now, Flora, don't be feeble. You know perfectly well you'd be miserable if you haven't a job and all your friends have. Besides, £100 a year hardly keep you in stockings and fans. You must have some ambition.
I do. I want to be a writer. When I'm 53, I mean to write a novel as good as Persuasion, but with a modern setting.
Well, how will you spend the next 30 years?
Living life, collecting material. Surely no one can object to that. I have such a lot in common with Jane Austen. Neither of us could endure mess.
What will you live on? Or off?
As you said, relatives.
Well, at Cull Comfort Farm, Flora gets a fine mess to clean up. The farm itself is decrepit and overrun with eccentrics, including Eileen Atkins as Flora's gloomy tarot card-reading auntie, Ian McKellen as a hilariously fervent itinerant preacher who delivers messages of damnation, sexy British classical actor Rufus Sewell as Cousin Seth, who dreams of a career in the movies, and comedian Stephen Fry as a fluty artiste who dogs Flora with his affections. The cast does bring that masterpiece theaterish sensibility to the party. They work as a real ensemble, not just a gathering of independent stars. And as a result, they have the kind of good, self-contained time the animals had in Babe and the humans had in Four Weddings and a Funeral. And another thing, sometimes in Cull Comfort Farm, the dialect is nearly indecipherable. Much of it was made up by the author in a wicked parody of Lawrence's overheated ruralisms. But I bet you'll walk away repeating many of the linguistic motifs. Lines like, I saw something nasty in the woodshed, and there have always been stark adders at Cull Comfort Farm. Which gets me back to why this cheeky trifle is such a breath of fresh air this season. It's one thing to glom on to a catchphrase or two from the Arnold Schwarzenegger or Jim Carrey oeuvre, and you'll certainly have a chance to pick up new choice nuggets from each later this summer. But it's much rarer to find a literate movie that does not carry the library shelf whiff of capital L literature you sometimes smell in films based on Henry James or Jane Austen. At one point, Flora's pretentious would-be suitor tells her, "I am engorgedly in love with you." Well, that's how I feel about this film.
Lisa Schwartzbaum is a writer for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Kathy Wolf, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.